It is 5 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
From Washington, this is VOA. Fighting around Tripoli Airport takes nearly 50 lives. Nigeria's government upbeat about halting Islamist insurgency. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. In Libya, nearly 50 have been killed in heavy fighting for control of Tripoli's international airport after a ceasefire 2 days ago failed to keep the peace Sunday. The battle between Islamist-led fighters from Misrata and Zintan rebels for control of the airport have spilled over into surrounding areas and are said to be the worst fighting in Libya since the ouster of dictator Muammar Gaddafi in 2011. In Nigeria, suspected Islamist gunmen raided the northern town of Damboa early Saturday, killing more than 40 residents, burning down homes. A military operation and a state of emergency have so far failed to quell the attacks by the group Boko Haram, which have included bombings in Nigeria's two biggest cities, Abuja and Lagos. Heather Burdock reports, however, Nigerian authorities are upbeat about the insurgency coming to an end.
Despite continued near-daily attacks, the Nigerian government says recent agreements made with neighboring countries will help end the 5-year-old Boko Haram insurgency. Doyin Akupe is the senior special assistant on public affairs to President Goodluck Jonathan.
We have what it takes. We have the military might. We have the resources. We have the men. And we have the will. Now that we have gotten cooperation with our neighbors, you know, in terms of intelligence and, you know, support, we will win this war.
Akupe says security forces are also doing everything in their power to rescue more than 200 girls who were kidnapped by Boko Haram more than 3 months ago. The failure to rescue the girls or stop the relentless Boko Haram attacks has sparked strong criticism of President Jonathan's government. Human Rights Watch says Boko Haram killed more than 2,000 civilians in the first 6 months of this year alone, the majority of them in Borno State. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
Meanwhile, the French press agency reports a cholera outbreak in northern Nigeria's Kano State has left at least 6 dead, infecting scores of others. A 6-day world forum on AIDS is underway in Australia with grief and determination as thousands of attendees honored some 6 colleagues killed last week on Malaysian Airlines flight MH17. The 20th annual conference will look at the current state of AIDS research, community responses to the disease, and ways to accelerate prevention and treatment. A joint statement by aid agencies warns 3 years after famine killed 250,000 people in Somalia, a new catastrophe is looming. The statement says more than 300,000 children and nearly 3 million people in need of life-saving food assistance. Unions representing striking South African metal workers have reduced their wage demands to try to end a 3-week strike that, coupled with a 5-month walkout by platinum mine workers, has undermined the South African economy. 6 striking unions are asking for wage hikes of 8-10% as part of a 3-year deal instead of 12-15%. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
Music.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, July 21st, and here are some of the stories we are following. Africa looks forward to next month's U.S.-Africa Summit in Washington, D.C.
Our own preparation, of course, is to bring some content into the discussion that will take place. We already have an idea of the key issues that will be discussed, and that is investing in the future and also looking at the issues of peace and security.
Irasu Muecha is the deputy chairperson of the African Union Commission. South Sudan's military says it has repelled a new rebel attack on a town near the Ethiopian border. Meanwhile, the South Sudan government accuses rebel leader Riek Machar of corruption. And an international AIDS conference has opened in Australia with an ambitious announcement.
Today, I am calling for ending AIDS by 2030. My vision for ending AIDS looks like this: voluntary testing and treatment reaching everyone, everywhere.
Michelle Sidibit is the executive director of the United Nations AIDS program. A London-based independent radio station ends its broadcast in Zimbabwe, and researchers discover a protein that regulates a diabetic person's blood sugar. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A senior official of the African Union says that next month's U.S.-Africa summit in Washington, D.C. should provide Africa and the United States an opportunity to enter into a strategic partnership. Erastus Muecha, deputy chairperson of the African Union Commission, says African leaders look forward to discussing with President Barack Obama issues such as investing in the continent's future and peace and security. Muecha also defends the African Union's recent decision to grant immunity to sitting heads of state, despite criticism by some rights groups that such an action runs contrary to the fight against impunity. Muecha tells me the decision is in line with what's done around the world, where sitting heads of state are immune from prosecution.
Serving heads of state and government, yes, was granted immunity, and that is in relation with the African Court of Justice when it was given mandate to try cases relating to crime against humanity. But I should be quick to add that this is not in any way deviating from what is in practice, particularly in many national jurisdictions. Serving heads of state and government are granted immunity. But for the African court, and particularly for the African side, you will also remember that this is only for during the time they are serving. Those cases will remain active if there is crime, and these leaders will be tried once they leave office.
Is this a reaction to the International Criminal Court, which many people say that since its inception, many of the people it has tried are mostly people from Africa? Is this a reaction to the International Criminal Court?
I don't think one should talk about a reaction because, as I said, if you look at many jurisdictions at the national level, heads of state and government are not indicted before their own courts. And so that is in line. And that is not just Africa. You go around the world, even where you are, the United States, that is the case. So that is not in any way a reaction. That is the reality of life.
As African leaders prepare to come to Washington, what message are you planning on bringing? August is almost around the corner.
I think it's a great occasion for Africa to enhance cooperation with the United States, the largest economy in the world. And Africa and the United States share a lot in common in heritage and the cooperation in many areas. As you know, many Africans or people of African descent live in the United States. And so this is a good occasion for Africa to chart a new paradigm in terms of cooperation. And so the summit that brings President Obama and many heads of state and government from Africa is an excellent opportunity to bring closer the two peoples, that is the United States of America people and African people. Our own preparation, of course, is to bring some content into the discussion that will take place. We already have an idea of the key issues that will be discussed, and that is investing in the future and also looking at the issues of peace and security, which are extremely vital and for which this is not really the first time that the United States and Africa are working together in those areas. But of course, this is now, as I said earlier on, would present an opportunity for Africa and the United States to enter into a formal framework on how to cooperate, because Africa has strategic partnerships with many regions in the world, with Europe, with Asia, even with Latin America. But this kind of relationship doesn't exist with the United States of America. And so this would be an opportunity for Africa to establish that kind of cooperation.
Erastus Mwecha is the deputy chairperson of the African Union Commission. He was speaking with me from Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa. This year's Global AIDS Conference has ambitious goals, notably to eradicate the dreaded virus by 2030. VOA's Anita Powell reports from the summit opening in Melbourne, Australia.
During the next week, about 12,000 delegates at this massive international event will discuss nearly every facet of the virus that has confounded the world for more than three decades. But first, they observed a minute of somber silence for the six top researchers and activists who were killed Thursday en route to the conference, when pro-Russian rebels in rest of eastern Ukraine allegedly shot down their commercial plane, killing all 298 people aboard. International Aid Society President Françoise Barré-Sinoussi expressed grief over the loss of the researchers, which included her predecessor, leading Dutch researcher Dr. Joop Lange.
I would love to be telling you that we were opening this conference in happier times. The extent of the loss of our colleagues and friends is still hard for me to express. We grieve alongside all those throughout the world who have lost family and friends in this senseless tragedy.
But HIV-positive delegates said they would not let the tragedy divert attention from the greater cause. Ayu Oktariani is a board member of the Indonesian Positive Women's Network.
I have been living with HIV for 5 years. I am HIV-positive because of lack of information. What happened to me is common throughout our region and the world. I come from the most populous Muslim country, but our situation is not unique. I am surrounded by peers from other countries, Hindus, Buddhists, Christian, and we all face the same problem. Many of us got HIV because we did not have the means to protect ourselves.
She says she and fellow patients are crucial to the fight against AIDS.
HIV cannot be solved by science alone. Because of the stigma of HIV, we need to include people living with HIV in the response.
The head of the UN AIDS body, Michel Sidibe, also expressed determination and anger and some serious goals.
Today, I am calling for ending AIDS by 2030. My vision for ending AIDS looks like this: voluntary testing and treatment reaching everyone everywhere. Each person with HIV reaching viral suppression. No one dies from AIDS or is born with HIV. People living with HIV live with dignity, protected by laws, and free to move anywhere in the world.
The conference continues through Friday. Anita Powell, VOA News, Melbourne, Australia.
It is Monday morning, July 21st, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time, 14 minutes past the hour. Reports quoting United Nations sources say South Sudanese rebels led by former Vice President Riek Machar on Sunday launched a new offensive on the town of Nasser, close to the Ethiopian border. The UN mission in South Sudan described the new attack as a clear violation of the cessation of hostilities agreement signed between President Salva Kiir's government and the rebels. A rebel spokesperson reportedly said the attack was an act of self-defense after he said the government made several attempts to arrest a rebel military commander. South Sudan military spokesman Colonel Philip Aguo tells me government forces were able to repel the attack and remain in control of Nasser.
The 20th of July, Sunday, at around 6 o'clock, rebel forces of Riek Machar attacked Nasser town, and the fighting continued through the day. They attacked the town six times. and the SPLA is still in control of the town. Meanwhile, the rebel forces have managed to penetrate into the area of, or the airport of the town. So this is a complete violation of the cessation of hostilities and the ceasefire that was signed in Addis Ababa, mediated by the IGAD.
Did you say, Colonel, that South Sudan military is still in control of the town?
Yes, the SPLA is in control of the town up to the moment we are talking. However, we are aware that the rebels were preparing to launch a 7 attack, which we do not know whether they have launched it or not. But up to 5 o'clock this evening, our forces were in control of the garrisons, but the rebels were in the area of the airstrip, which the SPLA was planning to flush them out. But we were aware that more attacks were being organized by the Riek Machar forces.
I think it's over the weekend, I was reading a story quoting the Ethiopian Prime Minister calling on you, the government, and the rebels to come to the peace table or else possibility of new sanctions. Is your government aware of that?
An army spokesman, and the army is an implementer of the government policies. We have been implementing the ceasefire that was signed in Addis Ababa, but the rebels have rejected it and they have never worked with the ceasefire. Whether the IGAD will achieve a settlement, definitely we in the side of the army will implement anything that the government will sign in Addis Ababa. We are aware of the regional mediations and the international community support to that mediation, and we appreciate it. But if you look at the situation at the ground closely, rebels of Riek Machar, definitely they are not for any settlement. And if they were for any settlement, they wouldn't have attacked Nasser this morning.
Colonel Philip Agwo is the spokesman for South Sudan's military. He was speaking with me from the capital, Juba. South Sudan's President Salva Kiir has accused former Vice President and rebel leader Riek Machar of corruption after investors allegedly stole money belonging to the world's newest nation. Mr. Kiir also accused his former deputy of fanning ethnic tensions in the country. Some analysts say Kiir's latest accusations could derail peace negotiations between the government in Juba and representatives of the rebels. But in an interview with reporter Peter Clotty, presidential spokesman Atene Weke Atene denied the accusation could derail the internationally backed peace negotiations in neighboring Ethiopia.
President's statement might have been taken out of context, given that when the president was actually saying this, he was reiterating what he had said before, that the number of officials were collapsed in South Sudan, because he has not taken actions against those, including Riek Machar, who was the vice president and the one who sit in the office of the president, when the president, the current president Salva Kiir, was the first vice president of Sudan. So the president was trying to say that if there is anyone who have set over corruption, it is Riek Machar who should be actually accounted for any corruption that happened in South Sudan. He was not suggesting that Riek Machar should be prosecuted or anything, because he knows that peace is crucial, and he has signed agreement with Riek Machar, which in any way would, if it is honored, would actually lift South Sudan out of the current crisis.
But the question is, why should the president be bringing this now when there are regional efforts to try to have peace negotiations to resolve this conflict? Don't you think that this will undermine peace efforts? These are concerns of South Sudanese that he shouldn't be bringing this at this time.
No, it will not. It will not undermine peace. The president, when he was talking in Wau, in his stadium, telling them what has transpired in Juba and gave them the chronology of what has happened in the governance. But he was not suggesting in any way, you know, Riek Machar should be prosecuted, because he knows if he says that, it will undermine peace process. And the president is a very intelligent person. He cannot just say something for the sake of saying something. He was giving history. What you have done yesterday has to determine what you should do today and tomorrow.
The former vice president was corrupt. Why didn't he make him face fraud charges while he was vice president? Why is he bringing the issue now?
That's a good question. First of all, the problems South Sudan has got itself in as a result of the former vice president being relieved on the 23rd of July was the same scenario that the president was trying to avoid. In any way, if he was to dismiss him in 2009 or before 2011, South Sudan would not gain independence, because Riek Machar, with the group who are actually fighting along his side now, would have caused havoc.
The president is also on record during this time accusing Riek Machar of using his Nuer ethnic group, fanning ethnic sentiment to attack other ethnic groups, including the Dinka in the country.
President Salva Kiir was actually asking people of South Sudan to refrain from using tribal armies. And he does not in any way tries to form any tribal army.
Ateni Wekateni, South Sudan's presidential spokesman, he was speaking with reporter Peter Clotte from the capital, Juba. The London-based independent shortwave radio Africa on Friday ended its broadcast to Zimbabwe after 13 years of service, but the station said it will continue to broadcast on its website and by what it calls various other forms of new media. Founder and head Jerry Jackson said lack of funding played a key role in the decision to end shortwave broadcast.
Well, as I'm sure you're aware, Blessing, that all decisions of this nature are generally made because of funding and lack of money. So we have to conserve the funds we have. So unfortunately, the only way to do that is to end the shortwave service.
So does this mean you will not be doing any broadcasts?
We're still broadcasting via our website and through the Channel Zim platform and various other forms of social media.
Obviously, one of the reasons why SW Radio was formed was to ensure that Zimbabweans have an alternative voice. Sadly, this has happened. What do you want to say to Zimbabweans in general, your listeners?
Well, we're obviously very sorry that we have to do this, and it's certainly not a decision that we're at all happy with. But if you don't have the money, there's very little you can do, and we would just like to thank Zimbabweans so much for their support over the past 13 years, because our first broadcast was on the 19th of December 2001, so it's been a long haul, and Zimbabweans have shared some extremely moving stories with us, and they will remain with us till the rest of time.
And let's also talk a bit, Jerry, about media freedom in Zimbabwe. Would you say things have improved?
No, I wouldn't say they've improved at all. As you know, there have been two FM radio stations given licenses in the past couple of years, but they're both linked to the state. So as from a broadcasting point of view, there's certainly no improvement.
Jerry Jackson is founder and head of the London-based independent shortwave radio Africa. She spoke with reporter Jonga Kandimiri of VOA Zimbabwe program. A single injection of a protein that keeps a diabetic person's blood sugar under control for several days could become available in the next few years. Researchers believe the discovery could signal a new generation of treatment for type 2 diabetes, a disease that is skyrocketing around the world. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
Scientists have known about the protein called FGF1 for several decades, but researchers discovered the potential of the molecule, which is part of a family of so-called growth factors, when they injected it into mice that were engineered to have type 2 or adult onset diabetes. The blood sugar levels of the experimental animals were restored to a healthy range for more than 2 days after a single injection. In the adult-onset form of the disease, the body's cells do not absorb sugar or glucose derived from food. FGF1 appears to resensitize the body to insulin, which transports glucose into cells, normalizing blood sugar levels.
So as a result, the combination of FGF1 plus the body's insulin rebalances the equation and allows the glucose to be controlled as if it was normal.
But Ron Evans, an expert on endocrine-related diseases, stresses that FGF1 is not a cure for diabetes. Current treatments for type 2 diabetes are aimed at boosting the body's production of insulin in order to lower glucose levels in the blood, but they can have serious side effects. If and when regulators approve FGF1 for the treatment of diabetes, it would have to be injected like insulin every other day. Evans and his colleagues at the Salk Institute for Biological Studies are looking into formulating a longer-acting form of the protein. Worldwide, adult-onset diabetes has reached epidemic proportions as carbohydrate-rich foods, particularly fast foods, have become readily available. Excess weight and inactivity usually trigger the disease. Evans is excited about the prospect of a new treatment for diabetes.
It's exciting because it's a new role for an old molecule. And it just shows you that there's a lot to be learned. And it's a lesson because after 30 years to find what may be the true function of this molecule came as a surprise. No one was looking for this.
Salk researchers report their findings in the journal Nature. Evans thinks clinical trials of FGF1, which he says is safe, will likely begin in 12 to 18 months. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa. Sporting here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we begin with football. Hosts Republic of Congo beat Rwanda 2-0 in Point Noir in the opening leg of the 2015 Orange Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers on Sunday. Lesotho pipped Kenya 1-0, Tanzania and Mozambique drew 2-2, and Benin edged Malawi 1-0. Elsewhere, Botswana beat Guinea-Bissau 2-0, Uganda outplayed Mauritania 2-0, as Sierra Leone dismissed Seychelles 2-0. Meanwhile, Nigeria Super Falcons are favorites to win the Telkom Namibia Africa Women's Championship in Windhoek, Namibia in October after FIFA lifted the suspension of Nigeria from international competition on Thursday. FIFA suspended Nigeria when a court order precipitated the dismissal of the duly elected Nigeria Football Federation executive from office. A sports ministry administrator was installed to run football pending the outcome of the court case. Subsequently, the court case was withdrawn, the NFF executive reinstated, and now the Super Falcons seek to reclaim the African title they lost to Equatorial Guinea 2 years ago. Ivory Coast eliminated defending champions Equatorial Guinea in the qualifiers. Following the draws in Windhoek on Saturday, the Super Falcons faced tournament newcomers Ivory Coast, Namibia and Zambia in Group A. South Africa is seeded in Group B with other regular campaigners Algeria, Cameroon and Ghana. Turning to athletics, Botswana's Nigel Amos won the 800 meters in 1 minute and 42.45 seconds, the world's quickest time this year, at the IWF Diamond League in Monaco on Saturday. Kenyan Silas Kiplagat triumphed in 1500 meters in the world's fastest time this year and a Diamond League record of 3 minutes and 27.64 seconds. Third-placed Ronald Kwemoi set a world junior record of 3 minutes and 28.81 seconds as Djibouti's Ayanle Suleiman and Ethiopian Aman Wote each set national records. Kenyan Jairus Kipchoge Birech triumphed in 3000 meter steeplechases as Botswana's Isaac Makwala placed third in 400 meters. Ethiopian Genzebe Dibaba improved her 5,000-meter world-leading time this year to 14 minutes and 28.88 seconds. Kenyan Eunice Jepkoech Sum was second in 800 meters ahead of newcomer Winnie Nanyondo, who set a Uganda national record of 1 minute and 58.63 seconds. Ivory Coast's Muriel Lahore pipped Nigeria's Blessing Okagbare in women's 100 meters to snatch third spot. Both were credited with an identical time of 10.97 seconds. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Almost 50 people are now dead in the heavy fighting for control of Tripoli's international airport after a ceasefire 2 days ago failed to keep the peace on Sunday. And a six-day World Forum on AIDS began Sunday in Australia with grief and determination as thousands of attendees honored six colleagues killed last week on Malaysia Airlines flight MH17. That's it for this Monday, July 21st edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as sports editor Mark Ouman, along with our engineer, Carl Sterling, I'm James Butte in Washington, hoping that you will make this week a very productive one.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com. VOA.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, Please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America.